and welcome to the interview series of Stevens Leadership Portal, presented by the School of Business at Stevens Institute of Technology. These conversations explore compelling topics at the intersections of leadership, innovation, and inclusivity. I'm Dr. Wei Zheng, Richard R. Rossett Endowed Chair Professor in Leadership at Stevens. Chris Ferrari, a Stevens alumnus, is the Chief Operating Officer at Hartfield, Titus, and Donnelly. Previously, he worked as a trader on Wall Street, built new electronic trading systems, and worked as a lobbyist during the Dodd-Frank legislative process. He holds a bachelor's degree in electrical and electronics engineering from Stevens. In this interview, he shares insights on how he breaks down a business problem into solvable pieces, how he communicates effectively between people from technical backgrounds and from business backgrounds, how he uses an educate and influence approach in his lobbying work, and how he believes that leadership is about confidence and humility. Let's have a listen. All right, Chris, thank you so much for spending the time with us. I really appreciate it for you to spend the time to share with us your experience and insights.
My pleasure.
Could you give us an overview of your career history?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I began my career, full-time career, after I graduated from Stevens in 1977 as a project manager for DuPont in Portland, New Jersey. It was a manufacturing plant that made graphic arts and x-ray films. I spent 7 years there in total. Migrated from a purely engineering position into a management track, which brought me to the manufacturing side of the business. My next role at DuPont would have been to relocate, which I did not want to do for family reasons. And I had an opportunity to come and work for a financial services firm, a relative in New York City. So I left my engineering career and began a career as a U.S. Treasury government bond broker. I did that in 1984. For 15 years, I worked on the phones, brokering the product. U.S. Treasury bills, notes, and bonds. Worked my way through that position to running a desk, managing a small group of brokers doing a more technical type of trading. And then in 1999, so it's 15 years of doing that, 1999, I had the opportunity to go to my management and propose that we convert our system into an electronic trading system, leveraging this new thing called the internet and connectivity and non-centralized trading systems. I did that for about 10 years, built out that business, and then in 2009 was asked to lead a lobby effort as a lobbyist during the Dodd-Frank legislative process. Did that for 5 years, then left that company and joined a partnership at Hartfield, Titus & Donnelly, where I am today as the chief operating officer for a municipal securities broker's broker. So I'm back in the brokering world, but as a C-suite executive.
Well, thank you so much for your overview. So can we start from the very beginning? What are some of your experiences during your formative years, childhood or early adulthood, that sort of have an important influence on who you are, who you have become, and what you do later in life?
Sure. Well, clearly I'd have to thank my parents for the lessons that they taught me. My father never got past the eighth grade, was a depression era child, and was very, very conscious of the benefits of hard work and saving. The one thing that he was more than willing to spend money on was education. And I have two older brothers. He made certain that the three of us had every opportunity we could have for education, right through college. He was very much, although he was uneducated, he was very intelligent and very wise. Most of his friends were professionals, doctors and lawyers. He ran his own business until he passed away. What I learned most from him in those formative years was the ability to improvise when solving problems. Don't jump at the first solution that might be the easiest to get to, but not have the best benefits. Again, the leadership that he showed within the family and through the extended family of coming to him for solving problems. He was a very methodical thinker. A very, very bright guy. So I learned those lessons from him. But I also have to say that I learned a lot of leadership lessons from my mother. And she was a traditional stay-at-home homemaker. She very much led by service to others. She's an extremely generous person with her time and her effort. If anybody needed anything, she was the first to run. Her mantra was be the better person. I think that was something that stayed with me all my life and has influenced how I look at dealing with people and working with people. You know, the good that you do comes back to you. Mm-hmm. In one form or another, you may not recognize it right away, but it was very, very important to me. And as I look back and thinking about your question, you know, that type of mentality doesn't seem to square with, you know, the rough and tumble world of Wall Street. There were many times in my career as a broker that I had to make a decision on whether to do what was right or to do what might make me the most money. I will tell you, I always did what I thought was right. And that's a lesson for my parents.
Do you have an example of one of those challenges where you're faced with the decision of either making more money or doing the right thing?
Oh, sure. You know, just to give you some background of what a government bond broker did in the day, you know, although we had electronic screens of our prices, the broker took orders verbally over the telephone. You know, you had information. There was information asymmetry. You knew something someone else didn't know. And it was your job to keep that information confidential until you found the right opportunity to do what was best for your customer, right? For if you were representing a buyer, trying to buy something at the lowest price. If you were representing a seller, trying to sell something at the highest price. Mm-hmm. I used to joke that our job was to make both sides of the trade equally unhappy. Right? The buyer wants the lowest price and the seller wants the highest price. You have to make sure they're both equally unhappy to get the trade done. But there were times where customers would say, you know, can you tell me something about it? You know, who's the seller? What's he trying to do? And that's, those aren't appropriate questions. You know, there were many traders that would not really do business with me because I would not give them that information. They would find other brokers that did.
Thank you. Let's explore your educational background a little bit. You had a degree in electrical and electronics engineering from Stevens.
Yes.
So how has that engineering background either helped you or hindered you at different points in your career?
Well, I think the first thing, and this is something that Stevens, I think, should be very proud of. When I went to Stevens, the first 2 years, the curriculum for the first 2 years was pretty standard among all engineering students, and then your junior you began to take more electives. But for the first 2 years, it was a very broad-based engineering education. But what they always told us, I think was very true, was we're not teaching you necessarily physics or chemistry or biology or a variety of, you know, thermodynamics. What we're teaching you is how to think, how to think critically, and how to solve problems. And, you know, going back to my early days with my dad and watching him solve problems, Stevens gave us the opportunity to look at a problem and break it down into pieces and understand best how to solve it. That ability to do that, and I was far from an honor roll student. Stevens was very challenging for me. But what I was able to bring with me to Wall Street in particular was, number one, an appreciation for technical people. Right. And in Wall Street in the 80s, you know, the computer people, they weren't called IT back then, the computer people were just seen as a utility. You know, they'll just keep things running and we don't really need them because, you know, our business is all about us and our relationships. Mm-hmm. And frankly, it wasn't until 1999 with the Y2K panic, you know, the conversion to the millennium, that the CIO was even in the boardroom. Right. Mm-hmm. They were not viewed as strategic business partners of an organization until the mid to late 90s. So when I came in, people were surprised, you know, why is an engineer doing brokering? But what it did for me, in addition to give me an appreciation for technical people, it helped me translate what we were doing on the business side into what the technical people could do for us. It was interesting because it was a more particular project where I wanted to create an indicative pricing engine so that it would help our brokers get a better sense of where a variety of U.S. Treasury issues would be properly priced. So I, you know, went to my manager. I said, I have this idea. He said, sure, you know, lay it out, see what it looks like. I sat down with our IT people and said, here's what I want to do. And they immediately said, I don't think we can do that. So I gave it to them in pieces. Well, you know, can you do part A? And they came back, oh, yeah, I can do part A. Okay, now can you do part B? And they did part B. Now can you put A and B together to get C? Okay, we did that, and that was about halfway there. And they said, okay, now let's look at, you know, D, E, and F and put all this together. And by the time we were done, they had done what they thought they couldn't do. I also like marketing a lot, by the way. So I needed to market this not only to my customers, but to my brokers. And I needed to give it a sort of a human face. So I had an acronym called Linking Using Comparative Yields, L-U-C-Y, Lucy. Lucy happened to be my mother's name, so I was a good Italian boy. I named it after my mother. And people actually referred to Lucy as a person. It was almost this extra smart broker out there that could tell you how to price things. And that was the beginning of my move away from the desk, you know, away from the telephones and becoming more involved with electronic trading, which is what I ultimately did for ICAP.
That's a very interesting example. Thank you for sharing that. So you were on the other side of the table. You were the person who needs IT to support you. But what about turning the table around? You are the technical professional needing to communicate with non-technical people. So there seems to be a need for translations. What are some ways that technical people can better translate what they can do, what they can serve business needs to non-technical professionals?
Well, I think the very first step, and this has been exacerbated by, the last 20 years of outsourcing IT. Mm-hmm. The very first step is understanding what the business is trying to do. You know, it's an interesting dilemma, whether it's business people talking to technical people or business people talking to their legal people, their legal counsel. There are many instances where in business, you're trying to do a certain deal, maybe merge with a company or sell part of your company. Mm-hmm. And naturally, you have to bring lawyers on to make sure you're doing everything right. And the lawyers will always point out all the negatives, all the reasons why you shouldn't do it. Mm-hmm. You have to be careful of. Mm-hmm. In my experience, there are times when if you purely listened to the lawyers, you would never do the deals. Mm-hmm. Right, because no deal is perfect. So at some point in time in business, you have to say, no, I understand the risks, I'm accepting the risks, and I'm going to do it anyway. That happens as well with technical people, right? If the people working for you on the technology side don't really understand your business, how you make money, how you service your customers, how your business, the potential problems your business would face, then all you're asking them to do is to solve one problem at a time without having that problem in context, right? So I think a big part of it is you have to engage your technology people so that you have somewhat of an understanding of what their process is, how they program and what steps they might need to take. But in exchange for that, you give them a very, very clear understanding of what your business is and how your business works. Mm. And what we found is when you do that, you wind up getting technical people that, number one, can help you solve your problem quickly. Mm. Number two, become more invested in your business because they really understand it and they want to help solve it. And number three, you wind up keeping those people around for a very long time. There are people at my former company that have been there since the early 80s and they're still there. There's nothing else they'd rather do than to work for that company because not only do they understand it inside out, they created the technology that built the businesses. And so they're invested in the business. Their careers are invested with you. You can't do that when you just tell people what to do. I think you can do that when you make those people your partners, right? Not necessarily equity partners, but partners in the future of the business. At least that's been my experience.
So for example, our university, I guess a lot of the people in our audience are focused on technology. So for them, what are some of your advice in terms of how to be able to speak the business language if you're working with some business people who can translate things like what you did to break things down so that they can understand it in technical terms and help out? What are some ways for technical people to actively pursue business-related knowledge to be able to translate what they can provide, the service they can provide for business ends, besides getting an MBA?
No, well, I think an MBA is useful. I don't think it's necessary. I think when it comes to what my experience has been, many technical people are incredibly bright, smarter than I'll ever be, but they need to have some humility to understanding what they don't know, right? I might know a certain level of coding inside out, and my own curiosity to bet myself might make me read books on it or break down other people's trading systems or other products. But when someone comes to me that is responsible for a portion of the business, the first thing I have to do is say, okay, I need to know what you know. I'm the technical person, right? You have to help me. Tell me what you know and how that works. And I have to respect you for that knowledge. I should be humble in my skills, right? I should be humble in my abilities to say, okay, I know what I know and you'll never know what I know. But there's probably things you know that I'll never know. So let's find that common ground, that common respect. You know, all too often you get this caricature image of the IT people who are, resentful of commercial people that might be advancing more than they are or making more money than they do. And they feel, I'm so important to this company. Without me, this company couldn't run. That's a really bad trap to fall into. And this is an important point. I've only thought of it now as a speaking way. Technology changes so quickly and it has for a long time. I graduated Stevens in 1977, and 4 years later, with 4 years of experience working for DuPont, a multinational conglomerate. The electrical engineers coming out of Stevens knew more about the technology than I did. My work experience was valuable to DuPont, but it wasn't really valuable in terms of furthering my education, because unless you go for graduate degrees and decide that, no, I want to continue to learn about electrical engineering and different aspects of it, your skills become stale. So it's important from a technical perspective, one, to appreciate, you know, the business you're working in, two, be humble in your knowledge and your intelligence, and three, you know, never stop learning. I think that's a trap that many people fall into, to say, okay, that was really tough, I've earned my degree and I'm done. Back in the day, it was more difficult to find those resources. Mm-hmm. Today, you can find those resources online. You can find them at any level of cost, from free to expensive. But it's stay curious, stay invested in your career, in your company, and always focus on the fact that you don't know everything, and you have to engage some sort of a professional mentor to help you, you know, further your career.
Great points. So let's go back to your career trajectory. So in your career experience, what are some major milestones, sort of successes and failures you've experienced that sort of formed you as a leader?
Well, I'll focus on the Wall Street career, because it was longer and had more turns. There was one point the company was merging and had hired a consulting company to come in, Capgemini, and do an evaluation of the systems that we used. The objective of the consulting engagement was to determine, you know, what systems do we have, which is the best of breed, which should we keep, which should we retire, so on. Mm-hmm. So my management said, Chris, you know, you designed all this, why don't you work with the consultant? So I worked with the consultant for about 3 weeks, and at the end of the consultancy, when it became clear of what the next step should be for the company, it was the consultant that said to me, so when are you going to do this? I said, when am I going to do what? He said, I spent 3 weeks with you. You've laid out the whole plan, and you're going to go back to being a broker? Raise your hand and say, you know, you can do it. And that was very important to me, because it took that third party person to sort of take a metaphorical step back for me to say, look, you've done all this already. This is clearly what you're interested in. It's what you should pursue. So I think that was very formative in my work there. So I did that. I raised my hand. I left the desk and built out the system. Mm-hmm. The next step, about a year later, I was fortunate enough to have a new boss on this electronic trading side of things. His name was Steve McDermott. He's since passed away. And Steve approached me and said, listen, the company wants to create a new division in electronic trading, and you've just left the desk. You don't have any experience within the company as a CEO in some way. He did. He was a CEO for another business. He said, why don't you work for me and we'll do this together? I said, sure. You know, let me see what it's about, how that would work. And what Steve did for me was to give me free rein to try out new ideas. I would bounce them off of him first. He'd give me some constructive criticism along the way. But he would always say, listen, I'm paying you to do it. Go do it, right? And I think, you know, between having someone that helped sort of push the bird out of the nest in the consultant and having someone that would let me fly on my own, they were really, really important to me in my career growth. I was never the person that was full of bluster and would just say, I can do it, and walk out of a room and say, now what do I do? I wouldn't say I could do it unless I felt confident that I could. And I think I was fortunate to have a mentor in Steve that I knew if it didn't work, if something failed, it wouldn't be the end of the world. We'd solve it and figure it out and move forward. In fact, I'm going to share something with you that goes back to the formative years, and this has to do with my father and with Stevens. It was the first month of my freshman year at Stevens, and I was struggling terribly. You know, this is, at the time, Stevens would have orientation, although this might sound like a wives' tale, it was very much a true story. At orientation, look to your left, look to your right. In 4 years, one of those persons won't be there. You know, a third of the class would drop out before finishing. And after my first month at Stevens, I thought for certain I'd be in that third that would drop out. I called home from the payphone in the dormitory, got my mother on the phone. And again, I was the youngest of three boys. My two brothers were older. They had graduated college. So now everything was on me to graduate. And my mother was very upset. She said, you have to tell your father. So my father got on the phone. And he said, what's the matter? And I said, listen, I think this is over my head. I'm not doing well. I'm having a lot of trouble keeping up with the class. I haven't really passed any tests yet. I want to come home and start over. And being the practical person that he was, he said, listen, I never did it. I don't know what it's like. It's paid for until Christmas. Just stay there. Give it your best shot. If it doesn't work out, we'll figure something out. And Wei, I have to tell you, I literally looked at the handset of the phone and I said, Dad, are you sure? And he said, listen, you're 18 years old. You're a man. He said, I'm sure we'll figure this out. Just don't leave. Don't give up. And that was probably the single greatest advice I could be given at that time, which really underscores how smart and wise my father was, because I did go on to graduate. I think you have to look at those experiences in life and never forget them.
Now I can't shake the image off my mind. You were staring at the phone and feeling tremendous support.
It was the last thing I expected. I expected him to say to me, you're not working hard enough. You must be partying. How much studying? And he didn't. He just said, listen, I never did it. I don't know what it's like. He said, but if you leave now, you'll never know. So just stay.
Wow.
And it was great advice. For me, it was the advice of a lifetime.
Any other turning points or milestones?
Well, I think in terms of leading a group, working for Steve in the electronic trading division, we had to build up a staff quickly. We didn't have a big budget, right? Because we're building something brand new with no revenue. The business was transitioning already. It was changing. It was consolidating. So I had a group of brokers that were skilled at what they did, but just unfortunate in their luck. And in terms of who their customers were, customer moved on or retired or did something different. Mm-hmm. So I brought on about 12 people into my team and explained to all of them that this was a new opportunity. If anyone was going to build a system to electronify what we did, who better than us to build that? Mm-hmm. Right? We had all the experience. We had the knowledge. Who better than us than to design something that people would find useful? Who better than us would be able to sell this to our customers because of our knowledge of the business? And they were very reluctant. They weren't sure. They looked at me and said, well, you're an engineer. I know you're a broker, but you're an engineer first. You know how to do this stuff. And I always found it very important to find the strengths of the people that worked for you. Mm-hmm. And I would explain to the brokers that, listen, just because what you did in your career, you found easy to do, it might have been easy for you, but not for someone else. And it was easy for you because you have a certain skill set. Mm-hmm. And that skill set made you a successful broker for many years. The fact that the business has changed doesn't diminish your skill set. You just have to refocus it. And I did a lot of reading. I tried to find some experiences that others had in leadership. When we spoke earlier, where we talked about that book, Moses on Management, which is a very useful tool to help people in a very short, brief read, get a better understanding of what it means to manage a group of people and how to get them to become the best that they could be. I am a big, big believer in hiring the right people and letting them do what they do best. Mm-hmm. And you have to do that when you explain what it is you want them to do. So I think that's an important part of it. And I think another really big component of it, and this is a lesson I learned at DuPont, one of my engineering managers has said to me once, the biggest problem we have here, now this is a big manufacturing plant with a couple of thousand people, the biggest problem we have here is communication. And I think that's an incredibly important lesson for us to always remember, that if you don't communicate effectively into the message you're trying to send, you'll be burdened trying to get that message across. You have to know your audience. You have to give them the incentive of having them invest in their future with you. I think people by their nature want to feel productive. They want to feel satisfied when they finish their day. I don't think people want to just sit there taking a toll for their job. And if you've hired someone that doesn't want to do that, you've hired the wrong person. So you try to surround yourself with people that are invested in your business. You communicate effectively what your objectives are. You constantly stay in touch with them and make sure you understand what their issues are and how you can help them. And you find a way to grow together.
So on this topic, in our prior conversation, you mentioned the importance of understanding people's history in order to understand their present day, the present thinkings and values and things like that. Could you say more on that? How do you do that?
Well, I think, there's some generalizations you can do. I think part of that generalization is, and sociologists do this all the time, right? They put us in these generational buckets. Like, I'm a baby boomer. There's Generation Z, and there's millennials, and there's yuppies, and all these different groups of people that you can begin to characterize. I think what you have to do is understand sort of where that person came from what made them who they are. When I applied for the job at DuPont during my interview, when I was asked about, sort of summer jobs that I had, and, if I worked during college. And when I said, listen, I worked for my father's business. They sold laundry supplies. I did mechanical work for him. It's probably not the greatest experience for an engineering job. And the plant engineer said, no, it's actually the perfect experience. What do you mean? He said, you worked for a sole proprietor. You had to figure out how to do things on your own, how to, make a customer happy with the resources you had. That's great experience. We don't shy away from that. We think it's a great way to learn. So what you have to, when you meet people and get a sense of who they are, are they from the area? Are they local? Are they from a different region? Are they from a different country? What's their family situation? Are they married, single, divorced? Do they have children? Do they not have children? Are they one of many children? Are they living at home with their parents? All these factors come into play when you're speaking with someone. And you have to realize you're speaking to an individual. You're not speaking to an employee. So you have to get a sense of sort of the background of the individual, and then get a better sense of what that individual wants from you. I had a woman that worked for me that was incredibly aggressive. And, she made it very, very clear that her objective in life was having my job. That's an interesting approach. Tell your boss, eventually I have your job. My response was, my job's not going to be here forever. You have to have your own job. You have to figure out what it is you want to do. If you're going to try to be me, it's not going to work. I'm not that good at being me. Okay. So you better figure it out yourself. But once she said that, I looked at her differently. And I had a different approach to how I would manage her. And it became an approach of continually challenging her to let her help her find what her path would be. So I think, there was a book a long time ago by a Morris Massey called What You Are Is Where You Were When. It was very helpful for me when I was at DuPont, understanding people. He uses an example, and I think it's an example that really clarifies this. His point is that the experiences we have at a young age help form us for the rest of our lives. And one example of that is music. The music that we listen to when we were teenagers is music we're always going to listen to. We're always going to like. It might associate us with a first date, with a party, with a big event in our lives, but it will be the music that we listen to for the rest of our lives because it was the music we listened to when we were being formed. And I think whenever I tell that story to people, they nod their heads and, I can see that. Because I do listen to the music that I listened to when I was a teenager. So if you take that approach to say, I have to understand this person's background, what formed them, now I might be able to figure out how to approach it. For DuPont, as an example, if you were to discipline an employee, one form of discipline was to take that employee off of the overtime list. So that employee would not be eligible for overtime. Mm-hmm. And would make less money. That was a very effective tool if the employee was married with a mortgage with children, if that was that employee's situation. If the employee was a single man who lived at home and said, great, I don't have to work overtime anymore.
Right.
That was not much of a punishment. So those are some things to keep in mind when it comes to both rewarding and disciplining.
So in your experience growing, developing into a leader, which I assume is very different from being an individual contributor or being a broker, what are some major learning you have gained in that experience?
I think it's important for a leader. Listen, at the end of the day, you're responsible for it, right? At the end of the day, they're looking to you for the vision of what do we do next? Where do we go from here? Sometimes being a leader just helps them figure that out with you, right? You take a very strategic and scientific approach to the problem and lay out all the options, lay out all the prompts. And so what do you think, guys and ladies? Where are we? And that's what they look to a leader for. You can't panic. You can't say, business is really bad. We're going out of business. We got to do something. Businesses go in cycles. Our business in particular, we're in the business of interest rates. Interest rates are zero right now. Mm-hmm. So our business is very quiet. It could stay like that for a period of time. We'll have to deal with it as it continues to develop. But you don't panic your employees. You don't tell them all the bad things that could happen. They know the bad things that could happen. So you have to figure out, how do we get the good things to come out of us?
Also on management, what are some ways you have developed your skills? What helped you? Did you go out of your way or very intentional in terms of trying to gather these leadership skills?
Oh, 100%. I read a lot. I continue to read a lot. I look to my wife, frankly, for a lot of leadership skills. She's an amazing person with very, very calm demeanor, very strategic thinking. I think it's important for leaders is to rely on other people that they respect. You never stop looking. I would never stop looking for a mentor. I would never stop looking for someone that I could learn from. I am far from the smartest person in the room. I recognize that, but I also recognize that I have a tremendous amount of respect for people in their personal situations. So as a leader, I think it's important. You know you're going to own the decision. You know that people are looking to you for that decision. One skill I learned was, you know, decisions are very easy once you have all the facts. Gathering the facts is the hard part, right? People have made more decisions, more incorrect decisions, because they didn't have all the facts. Maybe they didn't research them hard enough, or maybe they didn't want to find out what the facts were. They were afraid of what the facts would be. So listening to other people, reading a variety of books on leadership has been very, very helpful. But understanding that I can't be someone else. I have to pick the pieces of the people that I admire most. I can't be Jack Welch from GE, right? I can't, but I can admire some of the tactics that Jack used. I can't be Steve Jobs, but I could admire the marketing vision that he had of how to use technology. So I think that's an important part for me in my growth, was to look at other people and take the pieces that were best of them. And hopefully I was able to build that into a person that, you know, I would be proud of.
Did you seek out mentors, or mentors mostly came to you?
I think it's a combination of the two. I did seek out Steve McDermott. I thought very early on, I admired what he had done in his career. And we had very, very good chemistry from the very start. When it came to mentors on the brokerage side of the business, I more often than not look to my customers to be mentors than my coworkers. Mm-hmm. And I did that because I admired what they did. I respected the path that they chose in the business, which was different than my path. So I wanted to understand, why did you go that route? You know, did I pick the wrong route? So I think it comes back to humility. I think very good leaders, although they might come across as people with very large egos, I think the best leaders are very humble.
Let's transition a little bit. So in your experience, you participated mostly in the private sector, but you had in-depth participation in the legislative efforts that created Dodd-Frank Act. Could you share some experience from that period of time?
I spent 25 years on Wall Street, and it wasn't until I went to Washington that I felt dirty.
Tell us more.
No, the system is broken. The system is run by a variety of interests. If you have enough money and enough influence, you can direct politicians to do what you need. It's just the way it is. Dodd-Frank came at a very important time for our country. The country was on the brink of financial collapse. There are components of Dodd-Frank that were incredibly useful and incredibly important and incredibly well done. There are other sections that had nothing to do with the crisis, but they were put into the act because lobbyists were able to get them into the act. That was very disappointing. I thoroughly enjoyed the process. I testified before Congress twice. I was particularly proud of the fact that when I would have a meeting with someone, we'd have a conversation, and at the end of the conversation, they would say, "So what law school did you go to?" You know, Stevens. I found that very rewarding, that I was able to quickly pivot from a commercial person to a policy person, if you will. I did that for 5 years. We formed an association. I was the initial chairman of the association. I made sure that our bylaws would have a rotation of leadership so that no one felt that I was trying to take anything over. Mm-hmm. Again, being respectful of other people's concerns. The Washington environment is, it's not a healthy environment. You know, I can use the drain the swamp metaphor. Mm-hmm. It's made up of people whose primary focus is to keep their careers, not to serve the public.
So were you bridging the private into the public space, public policy space? How did you adapt? What kind of things did you have to adapt in terms of how you operated, and how did you get people to work together?
So I think when I was asked to do this, gave it some thought, and I said, listen, we can't convince someone to think the way that we do unless they really understand where we're coming from. So I proposed this educate and then influence model. And the idea behind it was, listen, if we can educate them on what we do and how important our role is in the financial markets, and answer any question they have about it, right? Get them as quickly as we can up to speed with what we do. Then explain to them of what we want is half the job, right? You can't go in at first and say, this is what we need. And then there's no context. There's no knowledge of why would you need that? When you educate them first and share as much as you can in the short time that you have of what your business is, then when you say, and this is what we need, they come back and go, aha, because I understand now. that allows you to do this. That's right. That's right. That's why we need that. You know, there was a big push during Dodd-Frank to make all of the derivatives trading go fully electronic on exchanges. These are very complex instruments that are not standard cookie cutter items like stocks. And they require a deep knowledge of what that particular financial instrument's going to do. It does take a professional to explain the situation and understand the situation and help trying to find the right buyer for the right seller. We were able in Dodd-Frank to have the ability to have humans as part of the process survive. That was our first objective when we accomplished that. That said, it was you're constantly battling the particular leadership of either the regulator or the legislator who might have had a different view going in. Mm-hmm. Might have said, I don't care what you say, I don't see the need for it. I want to go electronic like everything else has. So you have to understand where they're coming from, why they're coming from that direction. Mm-hmm. And again, try to educate them to the point where you get them to basically sell what you're trying to sell.
That's great insights. Thank you. Let's pivot a little bit more to talk about COVID-19. Okay. So what are some big trends in the circles you travel in terms of from COVID-19 that's probably going to have a long-lasting impact?
Well, for our business, we were able to, in about 2 weeks' time, back in March, provide the necessary technology to have all of our brokers work from home. We had already, our trading system was on web-based servers. Our intercom system was web-based. We were able to, our telephone system was web-based. So we were able to migrate our brokers very quickly to let them work from home. I would say we probably did that and maintained 85 or 90% efficiency. I think we lost a little bit by not sitting next to each other. For our customers, I think it was more difficult. I think for the traders, the customers, the people that we call our customers, they benefited from being in a room together as a group. They benefited from sharing ideas, sharing trading strategies, and not just for a 15 or 20 minute meeting in the morning, but all throughout the day, right? Mm-hmm. You know, President Trump is speaking right now. What's he saying? What's that going to do to the market? Mm-hmm. How does that impact us? So I think short term, the market did okay. I don't think it's going to work long term. I think people need to get back to work, need to get back into an office environment. You know, one thing I learned in thermodynamics was entropy. You know, entropy is the ability for something to slowly just fall apart unless you put energy in it to keep it together. I think COVID-19 exposed entropy in many people, in many organizations. And in order to keep things together, you have to work at it. Certain people can work alone. They're disciplined enough. They're dedicated enough. They understand their role in a company and they focus on it 24 hours a day, not just 8. Other people have difficulty focusing at work. And putting them at home makes it almost impossible. So that's where I think I'm coming from when it comes to COVID. I think a year from now we'll be working back in the office, everyone. Mm-hmm. I think our cities are designed to work with people. I think until New York City finds a way to make the subway safe, people won't come back. But once they do, people will come back. There's a lot of people that are really suffering right now. And it's very sad because if you just took the trend as it is, it's pretty negative. I think you have to say, this too shall pass and we'll figure out what's next.
What are some innovations you have seen that you really think would be promising for the future, even post-COVID?
I think the productivity gains that we saw from things like Microsoft Office in the 80s and 90s, the productivity gains of the internet connecting businesses in real time, I think artificial intelligence and machine learning are going to accelerate those productivity gains. I think that they will help people make decisions, make better informed decisions. I think that people have recognized that you have to embrace technology to make your business better. You can't just ignore it. You can't just say, well, I'm not going to do it. I think that a lasting trend to some extent will be a certain set of people that will continue to work remotely. I think companies are going to see that perhaps I don't have to have an expensive 30,000 square feet in New York City. I can have 15,000 square feet in New Jersey and 15,000 square feet in Florida. And I can run my business pretty well that way. I think companies are looking very closely at tax structures, tax rates, what's important for them. But I think I think technology helps you figure those things out more quickly.
Now, on a more personal note, what kind of things do you do to sort of keep on top of various changes or information in your industry or the areas you're interested in? Where do you get your information?
Well, I use, there are certain industry websites. One is called the Tab Forum, Trade Magazine. There's different sites that you can help learn that. I do read the Wall Street Journal. I get a lot of insights on Twitter, frankly.
What do you follow on from Twitter?
Oh, a bunch of different people. No, but the caution with Twitter and with any of the social media sites is, and I'm very conscious of this, they really tend to create echo chambers, right? You really tend to only see the news that you want to see. I consciously make an effort to follow people from different viewpoints because I don't want to fall into that trap, right? I don't want to be in a conversation where I don't know what Rachel Maddow had to say or what Brett Baer had to say or Britt Hume or someone else. You know, I follow writers. I follow people like Matt Taibbi, who I think is a very, very honest person in his viewpoints. Dave Rubin, who's an interesting writer. So I think, I try to look at all different aspects, all different approaches, and figure out, why do they think they're right?
Excellent, excellent. That's actually all of my questions. Is there anything else you'd like to leave for our audience?
I think in closing would be, I think really good leaders have a balance of confidence and humility. It's an important mix.
Great, confidence and humility. Thank you so much, Chris, for sharing your insights. I appreciate it.
Take care.
Thank you for joining us today. You can find more compelling stories and evidence-based insights at the Stevens Leadership Portal website. Our purpose is to inspire new ways of thinking, leading, and problem solving.